Morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's February 26th. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, we did have some snow showers here, light snow showers overnight for our resorts, but really the far northern resorts are the ones that picked up a few inches. Everybody else was maybe seeing a dusting to an inch here across the central and southern Wasatch. And honestly, that was expected because this is just the first of three different waves of snow that come in. This is the weakest of the bunch. It will more or less dissipate here in the next little while, if you haven't already noticed. And we'll see a little bit of sunshine, at least to start the day, mixed in with the clouds. But the clouds are already on the move here, heading from southern Idaho into northern Utah, and it's associated with a fairly potent cold front to go with it. So we'll start actually, we will have a break in the precip through about mid-afternoon. And then as that front approaches, we'll see the wind start to crank, and the direction of the wind will go from more of a southerly flow to a west to northwest flow with a passage. But behind the front is a moderate to heavy band of initial snowfall that will come through the valleys and mountain locations across northern Utah. And because of that reason and the timing, which is going to be about 6 o'clock, we are looking about the latter half of the evening commute, especially over Parleys and those that live in the Wasatch Back, to get a little dicey because the snow will come down pretty heavy and it will accumulate rapidly on all surfaces since it will be a lot colder behind that front. Plus you add on the wind and you might even get a little bit of blowing snow to go with the reduced visibility. So that'll be a quick moving band of snow. Then it becomes more showery. The mountains will start to see intensification overnight and then widespread snow throughout all of northern Utah tomorrow. And this will lead to 3 to 6 inches for Park City proper and anywhere in the 5 to 10 range for the mountains adjacent to Park City. So Park City Mountain Resort and Deer Valley with higher amounts in the Cottonwoods. Now we'll see much colder air move in behind it. So tomorrow you're only looking at the low 20s. And Sunday morning with clear skies, it's going to be below zero to start your day and upper 20s to end it with more sunshine. All of next week, I don't see much in the way of storms. It looks to be drier and warmer as we head into the mid 40s by the time we get to the midweek time frame. So enjoy this storm because we won't see one for a while.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Adam.
You bet. Thank you.
And on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Greg. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Yeah, you just heard the weather forecast. So we have snow in the forecast.
Not expecting much this morning, but certainly later today, overnight into tomorrow. But ahead of the storm is the winds, really strong winds today at the mid and upper elevations. Gusts in the 30s and 40s at mid elevations. Near 70s at the upper elevations. So winds are going to be moving snow today. We didn't hear any reports of avalanches from the backcountry yesterday, and overall it's been pretty quiet this past week in terms of backcountry avalanches. A few reasons for that. One, I think just the snowpack has been slowly adjusting to the big snows from the previous week. And also, I think people have just done a nice job of avoiding avalanche terrain and staying on lower angles. So we still do have this persistent weak layer problem we're talking about, and I think the snowpack has been adjusting, but the winds today, and especially overnight, and at least going into tomorrow, what they're going to be doing is they're going to be adding a new load, a new stress to our very persistent weak layer. So today I'd be particularly cautious of slopes with fresh wind drifts. These are at mid and upper elevations. Upper elevations pretty much all the way around the compass, north, south, east, west. Mid elevations really focused on west to north to southeast. And I think it's possible we're going to see this weak layer become active with these strong winds and snowfall, particularly going into tonight, into tomorrow. Also, just look for just some fresh wind-drifted snow. We had a lot of low-density snow on Wednesday, and today's winds are going to be creating some pockets of fresh drifts at the mid and upper elevations. Although the winds are westerly, when the winds are this strong, they can pretty much load snow on any aspect. We call it cross-loading. And you also can see fresh wind drifts well down below ridge lines. So Today we're dealing with a moderate danger at the mid and upper elevations, which means human-triggered avalanches are possible, and these strong winds will create sensitive wind drifts on all aspects of mid upper elevations. Avalanches may also break down 4 to 6 feet deep and hundreds of feet wide on mid and upper elevation slopes facing west through north and southeast. And with strong winds like this, just watch for changing avalanche conditions today, and a rising avalanche danger is possible. And looking for, upwards of 8 to 10 inches of snow, I think we'll see on the Park City Ridgeline and perhaps over a foot in the Cottonwoods. And, next week is looking dry, but some hints of promise about a week out. We'll see.
Okay, thanks, Greg. And stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County School District Superintendent Paul Sweat. Later on, Park City Council Member Max Doyle on the phone with a recap of last night's meeting. And finally, KPCW President and General Manager Renee Miller with a preview of our spring pledge drive starting on Monday. Stay with us. Taking a look at some local news now, a Parkite could be the next American Idol. KPCW Jessica Zoll has more on the 20-year-old contestant for this season.
I say thank you for pulling me through. I'm a lucky man.
If you ever stood in a lift line, dined at the Black Diamond Lodge, or walked around the Park City Market, you might have heard Wyatt Pike singing and playing his guitar. The Park City local has been playing gigs around the town for years and released a 5-song record last year titled Brand New Boy. Back in November, he flew out to Ojai, California, to audition for American Idol.
I went in with the mindset that I wanted to show them that I could sing, but also that I could play guitar, because that kind of goes hand in hand, at least for me. And also I wanted to tell a story and explain who I was.
He says he grew up watching the show, and when the opportunity to audition came along, he couldn't say no.
And I remember being in the living room watching Philip Phillips come out with a marching band and thought it was incredible. And that definitely sparked some guitar playing in my bedroom all night, keeping my sister and my parents up.
Like many things this past year, the pandemic changed how auditions work. Pike had to go through a series of Zoom auditions, and when he finally performed for the judges in person, he picked an original song.
So I actually went in with a song that I wrote that I released last year. It's called Best For You. I wrote it about my sister and figured that was a great one to kind of share the story of who I was and that I'm a writer and a singer and a guitar player. And so I went in and played that as best I could, and don't want to reveal the results by accident, but it was awesome.
Pike can't reveal if he made it past the first audition until the episode airs. He says he should be on the show sometime in the next few weeks. American Idol airs every Sunday at 8, 7 Central. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, a Park City High School senior was chosen to represent Utah in the prestigious United States Senate Youth Program. Caroline Waldman will join Senators Mitt Romney and Mike Lee next month representing Utah during the 59th annual U.S. Senate Youth Program Washington Week. It'll be held virtually March 14th through the 17th. According to Waldman's dad, who did some research, it was 33 years ago the last time a Park City High School sent a student to the program. Robin Austin manages the Utah Senate program for the state. He says he can't recollect the last time that a Park City student was selected, but he notes that all of the kids who get nominated by teachers or principals are winners.
They're like little Mozarts. I mean, you read their resumes and the kinds of service they've done and the kinds of ways they've been connected in their community already at the ages they are, and you think to yourself, what am I, a schlemiel? I mean, I'm just like, I can't get this. It's just amazing. So they're just amazing kids.
Waldman was nominated for her participation on the National Honor Society and debate team. Once nominated, she had a lot of work to do to prepare for the selection process among all of the Utah nominees.
We had to write a 20-page portfolio. I think there were 4 or 5 sections, and it was supposed to encompass basically everything that you've done throughout high school. You had photos. I wrote little like essays for different activities that were really important to me. And you sent that into I think the board, the panel of people who were judging. And then we had a day of competition where you wrote a timed essay. We weren't given the prompt beforehand. It was just like, here's the prompt, go, you have 45 minutes. We competed in a roundtable discussion, which I think was really interesting. Then you did an impromptu speech. And then I think they took all of that into account, announced the five finalists.
From the five finalists, the Hearst Foundation selected the two Utah winners and the two alternates. She's hopeful that delegates will get to meet the president, a Supreme Court justice, and even some cabinet members. She and the other Utah delegate have already discussed their questions for Utah's two senators.
We want to ask Mitt Romney a lot about, you know, he was governor of Massachusetts, and now he's part of Utah's representative government. And we want to know kind of how he feels about that. Also, he, you know, is pretty famous, I guess, for not necessarily going along with the rest of his party, which we both think is really cool. But we wanted to ask him more about how he's kind of come to that sort of worldview and stance as a politician.
And anything in particular for Mike Lee at this point?
Kind of. We have more like policy-based questions for him that we thought of.
Had it been any other year, all of the delegates would be enjoying an all-expense-paid trip to Washington, D.C., but like so many of the other COVID losses, they too will have to experience this virtually. Austin says that they tried to replicate the live experience the best they could. As one of the judges, Austin's confident that America is in good hands with these future leaders.
I get to realize that my Social Security is probably in good hands, you know, that these students are just amazing. And, you know, the Republic is in good hands. We've got just some amazing, amazing young people in the state.
All of the delegates received an unrestricted $10,000 college scholarship. Waldman hasn't committed to her college offers yet, but she says she is leaning toward the University of Chicago, where she thinks she'll study economics and philosophy before going on to law school. Well, a number of administrative changes will be occurring for next school year throughout the Wasatch County School District. On the phone with an update, I have Superintendent Paul Sweat. Good morning, Superintendent.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, so there are a bunch of changes. Was there one thing that got the ball rolling or one change that kind of snowballed into all the other changes? Or?
Well, yeah, I think there was. We had one of our beloved elementary principals that has worked in Wasatch County School District for close to 40 years, Ms. Deanna Lloyd. And she announced her retirement, and that's what got the ball rolling. That's what spurred the rest of the changes. And you know, in an organization, sometimes something like that, there's maybe some changes that were anticipated for the last year or two, and this gave us an opportunity to spur some renewal in our schools and our school district, and we're really excited about the changes.
Okay, so one of the changes I noticed is Dr. Ben Springer, currently the special education director, will become the director of the Wasatch Education Center. What's that?
Well, the technical term for that is our center that will run in the evening time at one of our schools. And what the education center does is it provides a place for not only students but community members to come and get instruction on some basic skills. We anticipate that there will be some social emotional type services offered, even in a walk-in basis, language acquisition for some of our English language learning families. Sometimes the students are doing well with their language acquisition, and this will give an opportunity for their parents to come and sign up for a class at the Family Education Center and take classes in the evening. That's just a couple of services that will be provided there, and then a host of others. We actually started this program. It's ran for two semesters. COVID helped to kind of shut that down and make it a little more difficult, but we anticipate this next school year to have that up and running.
Okay.
On a full-time basis.
And that's different than the alternative high school.
Yeah, that's very different. We call it the Family Education Center, and it's kind of a community place for students and parents and even other community members to come and work on different social types of skills, pick up some that social emotional support that they need, and also other basic skills that will help them function better as community members.
So, have you filled all of your positions, or do you need to still hire some for some of the positions?
No, we are after the after the changes. We now need to hire some assistant principals. Our entry level administrative position is an assistant principal, and that's where we like to start folks. And so we're just in the process of doing that. We have four assistant principalships open. We had a large number of very highly qualified candidates, over 70 that applied. We interviewed a number of those in a first round setting, and we're just now ready to move on to our second round of interviews.
Okay. The school board met in like a 5-hour retreat last week. Can you kind of highlight some of the takeaways from that?
Yeah, that was a wonderful afternoon and evening for our school board. We have two new members of a 5-member board, and great opportunity for the board to spend some time with one another, get to know each other a little better, understand some of the pertinent issues that are facing us in this upcoming year. And it was really a great evening. We started at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We started out by having a discussion about what the purpose is of the school district. We like to bring the focus back. Sometimes we get caught up as policymakers and administrators at the district office in some of the gobbledygook of running a district, and it's always nice to bring that back and remember that our number one charge is to educate children, and the greatest gift we can give to our students is that of high achievement, and it was nice to spend a couple hours with the board and visit with them about why we exist, and that is to educate children.
So let's talk a little bit about the latest with master planning and a school bond that was brought to voters back in 2019. Do you plan to bring that back to voters this year or next?
It won't be coming back this year. We can definitively answer that question. We're not sure if the following year will be the year or not. I would say that it needs to happen sooner than later. We continue to experience rapid growth here in Wasatch County, and yes, we need to move forward with providing more space for kids in our district, and so I anticipate it will be sooner than later, but not this year.
Yeah, and I guess I'm asking some of the other school districts that are going through similar growing pains and talking about new buildings. What have we learned, I guess, from going to virtual learning? I mean, since we've found out that some kids can learn from home, is there a need to build new big buildings, or do we need to build kind of different buildings than what we've always done?
I think what we've learned, and if you if you were to visit with other superintendents from around the state, I think they would all, at least a great majority of them, would echo that the largest problem we've ran into with online learning is some of the achievement gaps that we're concerned about with kids from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, English language learners, and et cetera, our subgroups have not done well with online learning, and really all the way through. Some of our top end kids, our high end kids, will do just fine, but we know that we need our kids in school. We need to be in front of them. Will it give us a little bit of relief on building some buildings? Perhaps, but I would say only to a very small degree.
Okay, so as we look at master planning, then we still feel like, or at least the board still feels like, they do need a new high school and a new elementary school.
Yes, I think that's a fair statement. The high school would be our biggest concern. Our high school continues to grow, and of course the COVID numbers this year, it's made it a little more difficult to nail it down exactly, but we know the growth continues here in our county. There continues to be large-scale subdivisions approved almost monthly, if not at least monthly here in Wasatch County. And so we would like to reclaim our building over that we're using right now as an overflow. We'd like to make that more of an applied technology center, which was always been the plan for it. So there's a lot of reasons why we need to move forward. We have the students now for two relatively large high schools, and the board does plan to move forward with that.
Yeah, any plans? Are we talking about some kind of facilities for, including maybe South Summit, Park City school districts that are really not too far away?
Well, I think that we do work some with the other districts, and as far as the sharing of a building would go, I think that would look more like something in the applied technology world. That program is a public school program. It's layered in between higher ed and K-12, and it's open to high school students for a very minimal charge, and also adults. I think that might be an area that the neighboring districts could share some space in.
All right. Let's see. COVID. It sounds like you're getting your staff and vaccinated. Can you tell us what percentage has been vaccinated?
It's a high percentage here in Wasatch County as compared to a lot of the other districts. We believe, our numbers show that that those people that are actually working directly with kids, that we're hitting about 80% that have now been vaccinated both times and are getting close to the end of the 2-week time period when they'll be deemed fully inoculated.
Yeah. Do you have staff that doesn't want to be vaccinated, especially teachers?
Well, we have 20% that chose not to. So,
okay.
Yes, we do.
So it's not a requirement of employment then, huh?
Because no, it's not a requirement. It's a voluntary program.
All right. Also wanted to ask you about budgeting for next school year. We had heard from the Park City School District. They're expecting more than $1 million in new funding from the state for the upcoming school year. What are you looking at this point?
Well, I wouldn't put a number on it off the top of my head, but we're definitely, I believe the legislature is working very well with school leaders. And I think this is going to be another good year for education. I think that the need is there, and they see that. If you'll recall, last year there had been a proposed 6% increase in the WPU, and with COVID going on and a lot of businesses shut down, we ended up only receiving 1.8 of that 6%, and the legislature has made it clear that they're going to make up that difference this year, and along with some other things. And so it will be a good year, and we're very appreciative of the work being done at the legislature this year to take care of education.
Okay, and have you figured it out in terms of all that tax increment financing that's happening as a result of the MIDA project area? Are you guys okay with how that's proceeding? I know that you
Well, we want to continue to look out for our own best interests, and we continue to work with the MIDA project, and we're working on some things to ensure that it can be a win-win for for the community and the school district. So we're always concerned about things like that, but I think that it can end up being a positive for us in the end.
Yeah, certainly. After the 40 years and you get all those tax dollars back, I mean, but are you working on some kind of like memorandum of understanding or right?
Yeah, I would say there's ongoing discussion with our MIDA people on some, you know, some ways to help the school district now, not just in 40 years, but now.
Okay. Hey, I'm out of time. I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie. Have a great day.
It's Wasatch County School District Superintendent Paul Sweat. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Last night's Park City Council meeting kicked off with another lengthy discussion about the Arts and Culture District. On the phone to tell us more, I have Councilmember Max Darnley. Good morning, Max.
Good morning.
So the big news out of last night is that the council decided to move forward with a future public hearing on the district. Do we have a date set for that?
We don't have a date set yet, but we just came to the conclusion that it's time to engage the community at a higher level to see how they feel about our plans. We've been talking about this pretty consistently at council meetings for 3 months. And we've been getting a lot of positive feedback, you know, some concerns on the financial side, but we're looking forward to hearing what the community has to say now that we have a general idea of where we're going.
Well, it is. It's a very complex plan, very big price tag. I mean, what kind of reception do you think the project will get? I mean, I've seen, I think, more negative than positive at this point.
Well, you know, they did a really robust, they had a lot of input early. I believe this was a Jack Thomas initiative initially. And the overwhelming majority of people wanted to see us do something like this. Everybody was really excited about the Arts and Culture Project. And, you know, per usual, everybody's excited with a drawing, but then as soon as you tell them what the price tag is, you know, the standard reaction is a little sticker shock. So that's what we're looking to get into is, okay, now you said you want this, here's the plan, here's what it's going to cost. How do you feel now?
So council members Steve Joyce and Tim Henney, they brought up the project's affordability versus the opportunity cost from what we heard last night. The city can afford the project, but Henny and Joyce had questions about what else the community could be doing with that kind of money. You responded with the city could be losing a big opportunity by not doing something with the property. Can you expand on what you meant by being a good steward for that property?
Well, we bought the property to prevent a big overpriced commercial development. Where you basically end up with another kind of overpriced place, underparked, overpriced place to go get dinner or different things, whatever those things may be, because we got a lot of negative feedback about the previous plan for the district or for what was going to happen there. So the idea was the city could step in and try and preserve this part of land as a community benefit. And that's what we're trying to do, is just really chase down what is the best use of this space for the community and for the long term. We already have, you know, essentially our entertainment district up on Main Street, and I think it's a wonderful place, but I don't think we need to duplicate that. And we want to preserve that as what, you know, for its current use. We don't need to duplicate that. And we have a responsibility to look out for the community. And I think the Arts and Culture District is a great way to show that we are looking to the future. I think it would put us in you know, a leadership position in towns of our size and in mountain towns. Having a world-class Arts and Culture District and a focus of our community, I don't go to a lot of communities that have such an incredible asset.
So do you support widening the scope of the ARST? I guess that stands for Art Resort Sales Tax, that would include arts and culture then?
It's the additional resort sales tax.
Additional
and,
resort, okay.
And so when that, you know, when that particular funding mechanism came into play, it was left as a discretionary to council option, right? But originally it was meant for, you know, we had, I think I have noted here, we had $15 million going to open space. We had, you know, $12 million going to old town service projects, some stormwater, affordable housing, etc. And we haven't spent all that money, and we plan to leave some of that money in. But that was one of the, you know, points that we wanted to come back with, is what projects have not been completed that were intended to be with that money. And yeah, we just want to make sure that we're being responsible if we do use that money. It could change the conversation if that money's not available to us. So we wanted to dive a little deeper on that.
Okay. And again, we're not talking about increasing that tax. We're just talking about expanding the uses for it.
So it, yeah, we actually haven't, we haven't talked about increasing taxes really in any way. We're just looking at using existing taxes for this. And Steve and Tim have very good points. You know, what else could we do? But Tim made some points last night. All of this money is coming from tourism sales tax, TRT, or the resort sales taxes. So this isn't, we're not taxing our residents. We are using the taxes coming into town from tourism to build a community center. And we believe that that's what was asked of us when we went out and bought this piece of property.
Not all, you should say most of it. Don't, isn't that more fair? I mean,
most.
Yeah. Okay.
Fair enough.
I mean, we buy lots of stuff here as locals. So, I guess
that's true.
Looking at all of the charts and numbers certainly makes our head spins. I mean, what's the one thing that you think the public should know about the funding for this arts and culture district?
Well, the one part of the conversation last night that stood out was Steve pointed out that most of our bonds, we usually do a 15-year bond, and if this were a 15-year bond, we wouldn't be able to afford it. So we stretched that bond out to 20 years. We backloaded the debt, so the last 5 years of that bond repayment is heavily loaded. My rebuttal to that is that the community benefit that comes out of a project like this is once in a generation. So it's not your standard bond. And I think that that extension justifies that change. But that is the piece that's kind of, you know, a little, that's where you get into the nuance of how do you fund this thing. And so Steve's point's well taken, but I came back with, I think it's worth it.
So in addition to diving into the financial sources for the project, you also heard three possible scenarios for the project, each with different build-out options. Staff is recommending scenario one, which would build the project in full. Council sounds like they were also interested in the other two options, though, that would defer aspects of the project, like parking and affordable housing. Is there an option that you're leaning towards at the moment?
You know, Leslie, it's really interesting. Every time I look at it, I lean toward a different scenario. Becca made some good points that building the affordable housing in phase one, or scenario one, which is the bigger price tag, actually makes that a more affordable way to build it, right? Because starting and stopping projects can be really expensive. That said, that price tag is a little bit hard to swallow. Tim called it a big gulp. And we're also sort of chasing down this public-private partnership option for our for affordable housing, trying to move away from the city being the developer. And this piece could potentially fit in there. And so I think we have an option here to actually not have to make that firm decision right away. I think we can start the process knowing that we're gonna do this over the course of a handful of years. And if we have to build the housing at the same time, we have some time between now and when we would start, you know, putting shovels in the ground to do the RFP and see if one of our private partners could come in with a number and say, hey, this is what we can do for you, and we might all like that.
So again, that big sticking point still seems to be the expensive affordable housing. What are your thoughts? I mean, do we put more there so the cost per unit is less, or do we think about moving those units elsewhere? And I don't know that that would even save any money by moving them over to Homestake, would it?
Well, the initial numbers show that the homestake project's going to be a little bit more affordable than this one, just from a cost perspective. And so I'm just interested to see a little bit more about how that can play out. And last week or 2 weeks ago, we said we want to put out for RFP all of the property that we would be willing to put into private hands and see what comes back. And I think we just haven't teased that out all the way yet. So I think we're all really kind of holding our breath and hoping that the private market comes in and they can help us figure out how to build these affordable housing units at more affordable rates. And we actually tackled some of the hurdles last night in amending our MPD, and maybe you're going to get to that, but making an AMPD, an affordable housing master plan development code changes that would hopefully make this public-private partnership even more attractive.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there with that. But you did hear get a legislative update from City Manager Matt Dias. He characterized the legislature as a circus. Can you talk to us at where we're at with House Bill 82 with that deals with the accessory units? I mean, it sounds like we've got some disagreement between the city and local realtors here.
So, I think we actually agree with the local realtors on, in theory, right? If you have accessory dwelling units that can be used for affordable housing, long-term rentals, then yes, it can help tackle our affordable housing problem. But right now, we have over 2,000 illegal nightly rentals operating in Park City. And the legislature, and I can't remember if it's a bill 411 or 401, a handful of years ago, they took away our capability to track down those units that are being used as nightly rentals through the most obvious way, which is going online and figuring out who's using them, and then go try and let them know that they're breaking the law. So we've been working with the legislature to try and open up our ability to track those people down and have them either abide by the law or turn those into long-term rentals, which would benefit us. So I think that the real estate board, they were excited about improving home values. Obviously, if you can build an accessory dwelling unit on your house, it's going to improve the value of the house. But the legislature is trying to take away our ability to regulate that, and or they have taken that away, and we're wanting to make sure that they leave that authority in our hands.
Okay, and quickly, an update on transportation projects was given last night. What's in the pipeline for this year? And is it all hinging on the Arts and Culture District?
Well, the pipeline, I don't know if you looked through the staff report. It is a comprehensive report. There are so many different elements to it that, quite frankly, I was trying to figure out what's going to happen right away. And they're kind of they're figuring that out in real time. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to pull it up right now so I can look at exactly what the list is and if there's a priority. They have them weighted, right? Whether it's a high priority, mid priority, or low priority. And a big part of what they're talking about is applying for grants and seeing what grants come through. And a lot of those grants are 80-20, so we would pay $500,000 for a $2 million project. And that was my question. Are we waiting on approvals for arts and culture? Are we waiting on approvals for the PEG development before we start those things? But I know they're trying right now to get, to attack our walkability and our, personal transportation as quickly as possible. But the specific ones, I'm trying to get the map up. I don't know offhand.
Okay, well, that's all right. I've got to leave it there anyway. Max, hey, appreciate your time this morning.
All right, thanks, Leslie.
That's Park City Council Member Max Doilney. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, KPCW's annual winter pledge drive kicking off on Monday at, what is it, 7 a.m., 8 a.m.?
8 a.m.
I should say, in the studio with me, I've got KPCW President and General Manager Renee Bodley Miller. So it's still another pledge drive during COVID. How are things going to be done next week?
We're going to be very safe. We're going to handle things the same way we did in August with one addition. We're going to have people fill out a COVID safe health checklist before they come in the studio. But it's going to be only two people in the studio with our hosts raising money. And we're going to stick to a tried and true formula. We're going to have area nonprofits host an hour. They each have a sponsor who gave at least $1,000 for them to come on the air. And we are going to give those nonprofits, Leslie, free underwriting for the amount they raise over $1,000 during their hour. So when you call into our pledge drive, you help two nonprofits at the same time.
Okay. So what's our goal this winter?
We're going for $200,000. And Leslie, this was what we made last March, which was the first week in March, which was right before the pandemic hit. So it's pretty brazen of us to put that out there. We were very fortunate in our August pledge drive that we were successful and raised $200,000 there. So we are really hoping that with our expanded audience this year, so many more people listening to us this year and getting online on kpcw.org, because we're all that COVID news, they're turning to us for that. What we're seeing is more people in that bigger audience who are willing to give us money to continue the service. So we're very grateful for that, and we certainly hope it continues.
So how do we see that? How do we see those increasing numbers?
Oh, you would ask me that technical research question. It's our website is where we're mostly seeing it, and in our mobile downloads. We are now, on average, seeing about 5,000 podcast downloads a month of our stories, our public affairs shows. That is up considerably from the year before. And our website, Leslie, from March of last year through January of this year, we have been up 120% of website users. We have gone up from 433,000 users to 953,000 users. We were just shy of a million.
Wow. So it's been almost a year since we've kind of dealt with the whole COVID situation. I mean, and I'll ask lots of people. I mean, how has it impacted, you know, like the school districts now? Do we need to build new big schools? Talk about how it's impacted this radio station.
Well, it's impacted us most severely in the other way we raise our revenue, which is through our underwriting spending. So, for example, Emily Elliott, our director of underwriting, was comparing February 2020 to February 2021 of the people who are buying underwriting, which is a fancy word for advertising in the public radio world. We are down close to $50,000 year to year. And here's why, Leslie, because most of the people who support public radio, who advertise on public radio, are arts organizations. It's concerts, it's theaters. They want that public radio audience to hear about the shows that are coming up. Well, of course, there are no shows. So those people don't need that underwriting. So we don't get that underwriting revenue. That has been the most severe impact on us from the pandemic. And of course, as you know, we're working harder. We can't just close down during the pandemic. The need for KPCW services is greater than ever. So we raised the bar. You and the news team have been cranking it out, and it's showing in the growth of the audience.
Yeah. So what will next week's pledge drive, I mean, will it look and sound a lot like it always has, or at least for the last several years?
It will probably not be as loud. We just don't have as many voices in. For example, our Board of Trustees hour, which is Wednesday at 5, we can't have 7 board members in at the same time. And I'm really excited about that hour, Leslie, as an aside, because it's Bob Richards' last pledge drive with KPCW. He has been the chair of our Board of Trustees for the past 7 years, and he is terming out. His 9-year term limit is done. And so we're excited about honoring Bob, perhaps maybe roasting Bob a little during that hour. That's Wednesday at 5 o'clock. And then there are two other big retirements that we're going to be honoring on this pledge drive. Scott Loomis is going to be retiring from Mountain Lands Community Housing Trust. They're going to be on Tuesday at 10 a.m. We want to honor Scott, of course, for all the great work he's done in our community. And you can't talk about retirement without mentioning Charlie Sturgis. He's leaving Mountain Trails Foundation. They're going to come in to host an hour of the pledge drive Monday at 5 p.m. So if you've got a funny story about Charlie Sturgis and you want to call it in and share it with our visitors and make a pledge at the same time, please do. I think that's going to be a fun hour.
Yeah. And again, why is it that we use nonprofits as kind of hosts of an hour?
Part of KPCW's mission is to support and enhance those nonprofits' work and mission in our community. So when somebody wants to come on, like Katie Wang wants to talk about the Park City Film Series, she comes in and she tells you about, hey, we're opening the Santee and you can have 30 people in there. We have the Christian Center on at the start of the pandemic. Rob Harder was on with you every week talking about how they were expanding their basic needs assistance program. And now their mental health programs are a big deal to our community. We bring those people in, People's Health Clinic. Cada Domingo, which is on from 7 to 10 on Sunday nights, is a Spanish language show. And the host, Jorge Rodriguez, brings in Spanish-speaking leaders in the community who help that community understand the services that are available to them through the nonprofits.
Okay. But again, in terms of what we've got next week, very similar. I mean, we've got the premiums. People make a pledge. We can give them a thank you gift.
We do. And, you know, there's some differences in the premiums because obviously it's been hard for our business community during a pandemic to even keep their doors open. So it's an awkward time to go to a business and say, hey, can you make a donation to our pledge drive? So we tried to be very respectful with the businesses that we reached out to, and we are so fortunate that we have the support of a lot of great businesses, a lot of restaurants. You know, we have Bill White Restaurant Group. He donated a lot of gift certificates. You make a $50 pledge, you'll get a $25 gift certificate to a Bill White restaurant. Sammy's Bistro, River Horse, Twisted Fern, Epic Promise has given us On Mountain dining certificates. So those can be good for next season. So we've been very fortunate to have some generous for-profit sponsors.
Okay, and again, the goal is $200,000, and where does that go?
It goes to operating expenses. You know, it costs a lot to run a news department, to run a radio station 24/7. And just yesterday, if you were listening to Randy Barton's show last night, there was a high-speed chase on 248, and all these callers were calling in and giving Randy and our listeners updates on what was happening. And we were taking static hits in our transmitter on Quarry Mountain. So we're on the phone with our engineer while we're also trying to handle this breaking news. And one of our transmitters is on the fritz. So we priced out what it would cost to fix that problem, $40,000. So that's $40,000. We just lost a little more than that in underwriting revenue for the month of February. So, you know, it's always, as the life of any nonprofit, money comes in, the money goes out. So the operating expenses of a radio station, it costs $1.5 million a year to run this radio station. And we try to raise $400,000 through our pledge drives.
Okay. Anything else you want people to know? Otherwise, they'll be listening to us this time next week.
Yes, I hope that they've noticed that we are trying to expand and we are trying to do a better job. You know, Max Doyleney was just on. It sounded like he was here, but he was actually using a new piece of equipment through an app on his phone that we purchased. He sounded more clear. You've noticed on your car display that you can now see the artist name and the song title when we play a song. Those are all new things that we've brought in this year, and there's no such thing as stasis at KPCW. We are constantly striving to do more and do better for our listeners, and we hope you notice.
Okay. We'll be back again on Monday again with the KPCW annual winter pledge drive, so we hope you join us and think about contributing. Of course, you'll be able to do that online or by calling in. Well, as we reported, the public comment at Tuesday night's Snyderville Basin Planning hearing on the Highland Flats proposal was overwhelmingly opposed to the project and easily outnumbered the four or five people who supported the project. In fact, some critics suggesting that the supporters were just plants that were cultivated by the developers. KPCW's Rick Breff got a response from the applicants.
Hillary Ryder is the spokeswoman for the Highland Flats developers, the Comena Group, Breen Homes, and Jade Breen, proposing to create 410 rental units, with 35% of those set as affordable deed-restricted housing. In an email to KPCW, Ryder said that the developers are acquainted with those who spoke in favor of the project. She said the applicants rallied people to turn out for the public hearing, just as opponents from the Highland Estates neighborhood did the same thing. But she said the supporters don't have financial ties to the project. Ryder said they spoke out on their own and are genuinely concerned about the lack of affordable housing in Park City. She said one of them, a teacher, turned down a job with the Park City School District for that reason. Ryder said she personally knew some service and health care workers who wanted to speak Tuesday but could not because of their work schedule. Meanwhile, Snyderville Planning Chairman Ryan Dickey told us he was gratified by the public turnout and it raises a question for the future. He said at some point the Snyderville Commission will get back to live meetings at the Richens Building, but the Zoom meeting Tuesday was attended by up to 238 people and enabled an outreach, he said, that they can't get in person.
You know, we had parents saying, hey, I'm in the middle of bedtime, but thanks for calling on me and gave feedback. We had a lot of voices would not have come to the Richens Building and that we would not have heard from had we met in person. And 238 people wouldn't fit in the room. So just really struck me that it's probably a task for us as we think about going back to meet in person, which is a lot better from a commission perspective in terms of our discussion, but figuring out how we continue to have all these voices, because as long as that hearing was, we had folks say things we hadn't thought of and voices that we don't see at the Richens Building. And so I don't know, I think that's a task ahead of us probably for all of our public meetings as we think about how to bring technology into the physical location or whatever it is. How do we keep that public input going?
Snyderville Planning Chairman Ryan Dickey. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
You've been listening to Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City.